And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and now joining me is environmental journalist Caroline Tracy, who has just released her debut book. It is part environmental reporting and part memoir, and the result is titled Salt Lakes, An Unnatural History. And obviously here in our state, we are very much in tune with what is happening with one of our greatest waterways, the Great Salt Lake. So I'm so excited for this conversation and so thrilled that you have joined us. Caroline, thanks for coming on This Green Earth.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
You are an environmental journalist. What led you to start penning stories or trying to bring information to light about the environment? What was that spark for you?
Gosh, I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and so I think from a pretty early age, I had a seed planted in me of kind of a need to think about the environment and conservation and environmental activism. And that grew, I guess, in high school, as there was more kind of discourse about global warming around me, I got involved in kind of that moment's global warming activism. And I always loved reading and writing. And so becoming a journalist that covered those topics felt like kind of a natural union of my interests.
And in particular, what was it that was intriguing to you about the Salt Lakes that had you, from what I understand, about a decade bringing this writing to life? Is that true that it took you about a decade to put this together?
Yes, the Salt Lakes, I always say, I didn't really find them, they found me. I, in my early 20s, went on some road trips to places around southeastern California and Nevada, and well, not only southeastern California, also the Owens Valley. And I was so surprised to find that in all of those regions, there were many salt lakes and salt flats. It was this sort of landform or ecosystem that I didn't really have a concept of. I guess I knew that Great Salt Lake existed, but it wasn't something that I was familiar with as a constant feature of arid landscapes. And so I was really sort of captivated both from the perspective of their beauty. It's amazing to come upon salt lakes when you're driving around the desert of the American West, because when you see them, they create a real contrast between the water and the landscape. And also the water having so many salts reflected in it is very reflective. Having so many salts suspended in it is very reflective. So you see sort of the surrounding mountains or the surrounding sky and clouds in this very beautiful mirror-like way. And at the same time, as I started to Googling and reading more about these lakes, I learned that around the world, they're pretty much all in decline. And so this sort of mix of striking beauty that had made me want to learn more about them with this environmental urgency that I was familiar with from other environmental issues took me on this decade-long journey to visit these lakes, to talk to people who were involved in their science and their conservation, and just to sort of think about what meaning they had in my own life.
And you mentioned that you were really diving into this global outlook of all of these salt lakes. So you span all the way from the Great Salt Lake here in Utah to Argentina and Kazakhstan. What did you see as some of the common threads, and what did you see as some of the differences when you're studying these different areas and what's happening with the lakes and how humans are responding to it?
Yeah, my book has a number of lakes from the American West, but it also has chapters about the Aral Sea, which spans Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Central Asia. It has a chapter about Argentina, as you mentioned. Mexico City was actually built on top of a system of lakes, the largest of which was saline. And then there's also a chapter about an ephemeral salt lake in Australia that I did not visit. So I've never been to Australia, but I did get to visit the other lakes that I write about. And I think that a major kind of similarity around the world is that water diversions for large-scale agriculture are a major factor in the decline of these lakes. So the Aral Sea is considered one of the great disasters of environmental disasters of the 20th century. And there, you had this salt lake that was the world's fourth largest lake, and now it's about a tenth of its size. And that had to do with diversions of the two large rivers that fed it for cotton irrigation. So for the Soviet cotton industry, essentially, they decided that Uzbekistan would be the region where they grew cotton, and they diverted pretty much all of the Aral Sea's inflows to cotton. And we see, of course, a similar dynamic in the American West, where crops like alfalfa have water that would otherwise flow into the Great Salt Lake diverted for their irrigation. And so there's a similar dynamic of water diversions. And I think, also the flip side of that is a very similar outcome of increased dust storms as the lakes dry up. So in Mexico City, there's, I think, a really interesting parallel with the Owens Lake in Eastern California, where they've both dried up pretty much and had to see a lot of different dust mitigation types of sort of trials and trial and error and solution eventual solutions for dust mitigation, including both of them have saline tolerant grasses planted on certain areas of the lake bed. Both of them have shallow flooding in certain areas of the lake bed, but both are these mostly desiccated lake beds that are now highly engineered and have required a lot of resources, both financial and material and sort of in human engineering brains to deal with over time.
Right, yeah. And in the title of your book, Salt Lakes, An Unnatural History, you kind of give a nod to human interaction and how we are affecting these bodies of water. I'd like to get some of the effects of drying up salt lakes on an ecosystem. So can we talk about the effects that this may have on birds, their migration patterns?
Yeah, salt lake ecosystems are very interesting. They mostly support two invertebrates, the brine flies and the brine shrimp. Those listeners in Utah are probably familiar with these species, but in many places people have never heard of them. And those are, salt adapted species that don't have a ton of predators because most creatures are not interested in making their living at salt lakes. It doesn't have as many things available for them to eat, like fish or other creatures. And so the birds that are adapted to eat the brine shrimp and brine flies come to the salt lakes, and they have a really nice sort of all-you-can-eat buffet of these invertebrates. And that means that salt lakes are really important for bird life. One bird that I follow in one of the chapters of the book is the Wilson's phalarope, which is unique because it's the only bird that migrates all the way from Canada to Argentina, so the entire length of the Western Hemisphere using only salt lakes. But the issue is that as these lakes shrink, their salinity increases because it's the same amount of salts over a smaller amount of water. And so that makes it harder for the invertebrates to survive because even though they're salt adapted, that doesn't mean that they can survive in any amount of salt. It starts to stress their bodies and all their sort of functions as they get to a salt level that's too high for what they're adapted to. And that means there are fewer invertebrates available for the birds to eat, and therefore less food available to birds. You sometimes see dead birds on the shore of these lakes as they get smaller because they just didn't have enough food to eat, or the birds stop coming because they realize that there isn't food for them at these locations, and we don't really know where do they go when they can't stop at the lakes that they normally stop at. And so I think that one of the groups of people that has sort of sounded the alarm at different lakes around the world early on are birders, because they are out there looking at the bird life and noticing that something is wrong.
Right, yeah. Like any ecosystem, it is layered and delicate. It's a balance and it's being disturbed. Can you share with me how differently the approach is to the lake and how it is utilized today as opposed to maybe how it was approached in the past by indigenous tribes?
One of the things that was a really interesting takeaway from my research for this book was that all over the world, I mean, going back to your question about the similarities between salt lakes around the world, all over the world, there were indigenous traditions that really foregrounded these lakes. These lakes are such striking features in the landscape that they figure into many different cultures' cosmologies. So one of the chapters is about in the book is about the Zuni Salt Lake, which is in New Mexico, and the Zuni Pueblo lost that lake. It was deeded to the state of New Mexico as a salt mine, and in the 1970s and 80s, they actually, with the help of a historian from the University of Utah, were able to get an act of Congress passed to restore the lake to the tribe. And so they're all over the West and beyond, there are indigenous traditions that have the lakes and their ecosystems at its center. Another case of this in Eastern California is the Mono Lake tribe is in the process of getting tribal beneficial use, sort of water quality standards for that lake. And then when you start to have a white or Anglo settlement in the region in the middle of the 1800s and beyond, there is a settler sort of drive to irrigate the lands. And the way that the story was sort of explained to me was that the two bases of Western water law are first in time, first in right is the sort of shorthand for the legal term of prior appropriation. And that means, if you arrive first, you have first dibs on the water and next person and after, so on and so on. There's a list of, priority. And the other key rule is beneficial use. And that means you can't divert more water than you're actually going to use because you would be depriving the next person in line of water that they could use. And that was explained to me by a professor at University of Utah that came out of Mormon settlement in Utah, that there was sort of this communal irrigation oversight of we all need to irrigate our own plots, but we need to make sure that we're not depriving our neighbor of the water that they could be using. And those two, that sort of the miners making their list of priority and the Mormons trying to do communal governance get melded into what we now have as Western water law. But the problem is that when you have beneficial use, this idea that you can't divert more water than you can use, combined with prior appropriation, this idea of a list of priority of users, the idea of the water you're not using takes on this term waste. And what that has meant over time is that any water that's not diverted, so any water that's not going to some user in the list of users, is wasted, and that's not allowed. So you're not allowed, if you are a farmer, to let water flow on to its endpoint, which in Utah is a Great Salt Lake, and in other places there are different salt lakes or endpoints in the ocean. And so it's been sort of a legal puzzle of how to make it so that water can legally just get to the Great Salt Lake. So Utah did legalize what are called in-stream flows, I believe, in 2022. And that means that some water has the water right attached to it of staying in the river and actually getting to the lake.
Yeah, and you do lean into hope in this book, and that many of these negative outcomes for these lakes could be changed through shifts in human behavior.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that was sort of amazing to me about researching this book was learning that this is a solvable problem. It's much simpler to figure out a solution to than something like global warming, where we would have to change almost everything about how we live, like how we get from point A to point B and how we heat and cool our houses. Everything would have to change. With the case of salt lakes, they really just need more water to get to them. And of course, that's easier said than done. But I think that there are some really promising possibilities. What's the sort of famous case in Eastern California involves the public trust doctrine, which says that states have a responsibility for the waterways within their border and for protecting them for commerce, but also for ecosystem and recreational values. And that has enabled the state of California to set a target elevation for Mono Lake. Another tool that's being tried in Nevada at Walker Lake is something like water markets, where there's a nonprofit organization that buys water rights from willing sellers, not taking farmers' water, but when farmers are ready to retire certain pieces of their land, they can sell it voluntarily to this organization, and they've been able to get a substantial portion of the water that they need to restore Walker Lake through that tactic. And there are also a number of sort of technical changes that are possible, like optimizing irrigation systems and sort of doing gradual efficiency changes so that water can be flowing onto the lake and not all being diverted on the way.
Okay, so we talked about in the title earlier that it says unnatural history and how you may be giving a nod to human interaction, but there may be another way of interpreting that title. Can you share with me how you weave your own life into these pages as you write about the lakes?
Yeah, my book, Salt Lakes, An Unnatural History, has two threads. So there is, of course, this thread of moving around the salt lakes of the world and learning about how they all came to be in structural decline and what different tools are on the table to try and conserve and save them. But then there's also my own sort of personal thread of my journey of a decade long of young adulthood and doing this research. And so the subtitle, An Unnatural History, my editor and I thought really sort of resonated between the two different threads of the book, because one of the sort of main changes in my life over that time was sort of shifting from dating my college boyfriend into eventually marrying a woman. And so there's sort of this queer arc to it. And we wanted to kind of play on the idea that, some people see like queer lives as unnatural, and some people see salt lakes as somewhat unnatural too. There was a scientist that I was speaking to who, with fondness, but, said that the salt lakes were freakish habitats because they're so extreme and so unusual relative to many other habitats. And so at a certain point, we thought we were going to call it, salt lakes, a freakish history or a freakish habitat, but we didn't want to say something that seemed that strongly kind of marked as negative. And so we went with an unnatural history, both because it has the opportunity to kind of encompass the different changes that humans have enacted on these lakes, as well as this sort of play on the idea that of queerness as being perceived as unnatural. But the book, of course, opens on to an idea that all biodiversity and all sort of diversity in life is good, right? That you want all the biodiversity that these salt lakes have to offer, but you also want that same degree of diversity in human lives and human sort of family or in household organizations, and as sort of as many types of ways of living as possible, I think, are a good thing. And salt lakes sort of show us that. And the third reason that we liked this subtitle was that there is a very well-known book about Great Salt Lake by Terry Tempest Williams that's called Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. And so it gave us the opportunity to nod back to that just absolutely foundational text about Great Salt Lake.
So, in looking back on this journey of discovery about these lakes, what were some of the main themes you really wanted readers to take away?
I think a big question that was animating my research and even just my life when I started working on Salt Lakes, and that I felt like I got closer to answering as I worked on it, was this question of how do you feel at home in a place that is really rapidly changing? Because I had grown up in the American West and I had been involved in climate change activism as a young person, and I was just very aware of the rapidity with which the region was changing and would continue to change throughout my adult life. And that was something that I struggled to accept, and I wanted to feel like I could still have a foothold in the world, even as I was prepared to be constantly adapting to change and constantly, in a certain way, mourning the things that were changing. And so for me, this sort of long-term, close study and examination and thinking about these lakes and the different ways that my life intersected with these lakes was a way for me to sort of have an anchor in the region, have a sense of hope about things that could change for the better, and also find this sort of just conceptual and emotional resonance between my own life and the landscape.
Do you feel like you had an affinity for these Great Salt Lakes after looking at all of this? And do you feel like it came a little bit closer to you? Do you have this connection to them now that it feels a little more, I guess, intense than when you first began?
Yeah, I think that when, you know, when you're in beautiful landscapes, this has always been something that's kind of haunted me of, well, how do you correctly appreciate it, right? So I would go, I remember arriving to lakes, like driving up and thinking, okay, what do I need to do to take this in? What's the right way to appreciate this? How am I supposed to encompass all of this from just standing at one point on the shore or walking along the shore? And I think that learning about landscape really does help in that way, you know, sort of being a naturalist of a certain type of region and knowing the different plants and knowing the birds and knowing a little bit about the hydrology can really make a difference in your ability to feel like you're kind of settling into the landscape and taking it in a way that's goes beyond being just superficial.
Well, your book is described as a dazzling love letter to a strange ecosystem and a moving odyssey into your own identity. It's a fascinating read. Where can people go online to learn more about you and this book?
The book is out in the world now. It came out on Tuesday, March 17th. And so it should be available in most bookstores, I hope. I hope it's available in most bookstores. My website is cetracy.com. And on March 31st, I will be in Salt Lake City presenting the book in conversation with Dr. Bonnie Baxter from the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster University. We'll be at the University Auditorium, and that is being hosted by Weller Bookworks, the bookstore. So I would love to see anyone who's interested in the topic there.
Well, that's fantastic to know. So that's March 31st, and it's happening where again?
At the Auditorium at Westminster University.
Well, thank you so much, environmental journalist Caroline Tracy. The book is called Salt Lakes, An Unnatural History, and you can hear Caroline speak more about her book on March 31st at Westminster, and more information about that can be found on your website.
Let's see, my website, cetracy.com, has my tour schedule, and also Weller Bookworks website has the information for that too.
And we will put it up on kpcw.org as well. So thank you so much for taking part in This Green Earth. We appreciate you, and the book sounds very fascinating, and I can't wait to get my hands on it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure talking with you.